Welcome. I'm Cynthia Barnett, an independent journalist specializing in water. I've written three water books. The newest is A Natural and Cultural History of Rain, which will be out in April. This morning's panel spins off lack of rain, epic drought in California that, as we know from Matt's reporting in the Sacramento Bee, has drained aquifers, fallowed hundreds of thousands of acres of crops, cut off 10,000 junior water rights, forced mandatory conservation in all cities, and threatens endangered salmon and other wildlife. As we'll hear from our other panelists, depletion of fresh water and conflicts over access to fresh water are urgent stories in many parts of the United States and around the world. So the idea behind this panel is to think about how we journalists can stretch our work beyond the typical cracked earth photos and water wars rhetoric to help our audiences understand what's really at stake and solutions. So since we have so many great reporters in the audience, we have set aside the majority of this panel for Q&A. I'm going to introduce everyone very briefly, then our panelists will each talk to you for about 5 minutes on what they think is most crucial for journalists to understand about the water story. I have a few follow-up questions, and then we will open it up to what I hope will be a vigorous Q&A. So first to my left is Jay Famlietti, senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and professor of Earth System Science at the University of California in Irvine. He'll show us new satellite tools that let scientists see the rate of groundwater depletion in our aquifers in ways we've never been able to see it before. Jay's work was featured in the film Last Call at the Oasis, and this quote from the movie really sums up why we've asked him to join us this morning. He says, "The view from the ground is muddied by politics. The view from space is clear and undeniable." So we'll start with Jay, and then I will introduce the other panelists, and we'll go one by one. Jay, welcome. Thanks for being here all the way from California.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. So as Cynthia said, I've been working with the GRACE mission for a long time, and I will show you a few pictures and charts and an animation from some of that work. My research group uses satellites and develops advanced computer models to track how freshwater availability is changing all over the world. And if you've seen some of our work covered in the press, it's likely the work using this NASA GRACE mission. It's a gravity mission. And again, I'll show you some other slides that get into it in just a little bit more detail. But one of the main things that we've been able to do is expose the tremendous rates of groundwater depletion in California, up at the top, in the Colorado River Basin, our recent paper, in the Middle East there in the middle, and in India at the bottom. And it's really happening all over the world. This is an animation. Here we go. Now, we don't want to end the show. So I, as you can see, I use a Mac, and so I'm kind of PC zero. Let's hope that this works. Is it moving? That date is supposed to animate there. That's going. Okay, so as the scientist in the group, I guess my role is to share with you some of this new data that really helps us understand what's going on with water availability, and in particular things like where water storage is increasing or it's decreasing, what are the rates of change, where are the areas of water stress, what's climate change, what's natural so this is just going to go in a loop, I hope. What's natural variability? What's a function of human water management? And so kind of like we're showing here in this animation of groundwater losses in the Middle East. Let's see if this can just play a little bit. These were recently updated to go all the way through June 2014. So, yeah, it's kind of cruising along. It's kind of like watching paint dry, but it gets progressively redder and redder, and you can kind of see this shape. Okay, that's not going to work. I will provide a link to all of you where you can go download this stuff and take a look at it. You know, just so we're on the same page, there's often a lot of confusion about the difference between surface water and groundwater in the general public. And so when I'm talking about surface water, we're talking about rivers and water that's on the surface, rivers, lakes, reservoirs. And when we're talking about groundwater, of course, we're talking about the water that's underground, stored in our aquifers, stored in soils, and stored in porous rock units. And that's really the bulk of our freshwater supply, right? It's about like over 95% of our fresh water is actually groundwater. So a little bit more about the GRACE mission. GRACE stands for Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. It works like for this morning, let's just say that it works like a scale in the sky. It's literally weighing places around the world that are gaining or losing water each month so that we can produce animations. That animation is actually pretty good, so of course it didn't work well. and charts and maps like this. And so this one shows the trends in freshwater storage in the United States over the past decade or so. And you see a couple of things. You see that the northern half, the blue colors, are getting wetter. The southern half of the United States is getting drier. It's shown in red. And then you see these embedded hotspots in particular places like the Central Valley in California, where, you know, some of you have written about it, we're having a terrible time out there. Also the southern High Plains or the Ogallala Aquifer. These are also our two huge food-producing regions, right? So things are really threatened, and sometimes that doesn't get covered. It gets a little bit lost in the media. Well, it's not just the United States. It's really kind of a global picture. And so for this morning, let's focus on some of these red spots, and in particular the red spots in the mid-latitudes, right, the arid and the semi-arid parts of the world. So the spots that are through here and over here and down here. So it turns out that most of those red spots sit on top of our major aquifer systems, like the Central Valley here, like the Ogallala Aquifer. Here's the Middle East, here's India, Bangladesh, here's the North China Plain, here's the Pilbara Canning Basin, here's the Guarani Aquifer in South America. So virtually all of these are getting hit pretty hard in groundwater depletion. These are just charts that show the sort of ups and downs and the long-term drop going back to about 2002. So virtually all of these aquifers are being hit really, really hard. So there's a take-home message, or take-home messages. We have a story to tell, and we need your help. It's a story about that human activities are unequivocally driving the current era of rapid climate change. With respect to water, we are seeing more frequent flooding and severe flooding and more prolonged and severe drought. We're seeing the dry areas of the world get drier and the wet areas of the world get wetter. And you can see that in this figure. A lot of the blue is happening in the high Arctic and in the tropics. And a lot of the red is happening in the middle parts, in the mid-latitude regions. And it's a story where we are really squandering and draining the limited available groundwaters that are within those dry mid-latitude regions. And so in terms of uncovered angles and that are important to cover. So it's a global story, but it has profound local and regional implications. It's a story that is intimately tied to food and energy. So when we hear about the food, energy, water nexus, it's not just a buzz term, it's a real thing, right? So that needs to be covered. There are deep, deep policy implications, security implications, infrastructure implications here. We don't have the international policy. We don't have the civil, the legal infrastructure in place, national policies to deal with, you know, this map. And the U.S. map also point to the haves and the have-nots of the future. We're not really prepared for that. So it's also a story of the need for a better management of our groundwater. In most places around the world, groundwater is really poorly, you know, we couldn't put together this picture without a satellite like this. So It's poorly monitored, it's poorly managed. Many of you know that until like last week, California had no real statewide groundwater management strategy. So, you know, imagine what's happening in the rest of the world, in the developing world. It's really a free-for-all. So that's why... these are the wrong... Sorry, I gave you the wrong slides. These are cool, though. Okay, these are cool. That's Oktoberfest. All right, we grow our beers. We're raising water awareness. No, this is, I'm sorry. Here we are. That was last year and the year before. Now that I moved to a government lab, they might be too serious for growing beards in October, but we're going to try. Anyway, together, we do need to elevate critical water issues to the level, really, of everyday understanding. And we need your help for that. There's just some contact info. A lot of you guys know that I am on Twitter. And a lot of what I talked about... So you can find a lot of resources at my webpage, including that animation, so you can download it, and other animations. And write for National Geographic, Water Currents blog, where I go on a little bit more length about some of the things that I just talked about. Thank you.
Jay, thank you so much. Next, we have Matt Weiser, Senior Writer on Environment and Natural Resources for the Sacramento Bee. In just the past few weeks, Matt has published a statewide analysis of water use that showed enormous disparities among different California communities. He broke the story that California allocates 5 times more water than exists in its rivers. He's written about new criminal penalties for wasting water. He had several other water stories. Again, this is only the past few weeks, all amid his earthquake coverage. So I'm so grateful, Matt, that you could be on our panel with everything you have going on. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, and thanks, everyone, for coming to hear about water and drought. Just to take off from what Jay was saying about groundwater, the groundwater problem in California, especially recently, it has been aggravated because of a scarcity of surface water, and that's the primary thing that we see occurring in the drought. As was mentioned, California has allocated something like 5 times more water rights than exists in nature, and it's actually a lot worse than that, because that study only looked at what we call junior water rights, and those are the rights that were issued after 1914. There's a whole massive collection of water rights that were issued before that and are even more loosely regulated. So it's likely to be a lot more than 5 times. And the enforcement of these water rights is very loose. We just heard how California only last week passed a groundwater regulation law. California has ostensibly been regulating its surface water since 1914, but if you hold a water right in California, you're required to file an annual statement with the state describing how much water you used. But those are paper files. They're not even filed online. They're not checked by anyone in state government. They're not based on any actual water meter or flow meter on your diversion. So it's entirely self-reported. It's entirely the honor system. And if you take a look at some of these reports, you find that many water users are not reporting their actual use. They're reporting the maximum their water right allows. And the reason for that is, in many cases, if you're not using all of the water that you're entitled to take, the state theoretically could come in and tell you you can't have all of that anymore because you're not using it. The state law requires you to put your water to beneficial use, which is growing crops or serving an urban area. So if you're not showing beneficial use for all of the water under your water right, you could have it taken away. Now that That's only very rarely happened, but nevertheless, it drives people to report that they're using everything they're entitled to. So that's another way that this reporting system is entirely inaccurate. In many cases, people could be taking a lot more water than their water right. In many cases, it could be less. There's really no way to know. The other thing about this system of water rights is it's just a really arcane and legalistic system. To understand how these water rights work, you have to go through 150 years of paper records. And many of them have never been explored before. So to actually understand who owns the water right, if a water right is challenged, you go to what's called an adjudication, which is like a court hearing, and it takes many months to resolve a disputed water right. And really only lawyers understand this system, and I hadn't covered it very much until this drought occurred, and I'm far from understanding the whole thing. But it's a rich area of potential journalism for anyone who's interested in exploring it, because it hasn't been very well reported, and it's not well understood. Now, even if somebody got an inkling that a water right was being abused, it would be very difficult to find out just how much somebody was taking from a stream or a river. In the entire state of California, there's only 20 people who enforce water rights. These are people who are available to go into the field and inspect a water diversion to see if the right amount of water is being diverted at the right time. And during the drought, and this is all overseen by the State Water Resources Control Board, by the way, but when the drought hit earlier this year, the board said, well, yeah, we only have 20 people, but we're going to ask our game wardens to help, and we're going to ask the State Department of Water Resources to put more people in the field. Well, these are all people who have other responsibilities. Game wardens in particular are also extremely understaffed. There's only about 200 game wardens for the entire state of California. Their primary responsibility is policing hunting and fishing activity and also water pollution. So they're not available, really, to help enforce water rights. So even in this drought, which some are calling the worst ever in California, there's very little enforcement of who's taking water when and how much. So as a result of all this surface water depletion, we have more people taking groundwater. Anyone who doesn't have enough surface water but has the means to tap groundwater is doing it. There's well drillers all over the state who are seeing record activity. Anyone with a high-value crop who has the money to put in a well is doing it. And one of the ironies of this heavy groundwater depletion is it's actually destroying some of the infrastructure that delivers surface water. For example, the Central Valley Project and the California Aqueduct, which run from the Delta south to Los Angeles and the San Joaquin Valley, they were built in the 50s and 60s partly to avoid groundwater depletion. They divert surface water to the south so that less groundwater would be taken from the San Joaquin Valley. Well, it didn't work. Didn't really work. And now that we have this drought, we have even more groundwater depletion. And these aqueducts, which are enormous concrete facilities, they're, as the land subsides, the canals are collapsing, and you get these dips in the canal, which limits the amount of water that you can move through the canal, and it causes cracks that create leaks. So you have surface water being lost through these canals that are collapsing. So as Jay mentioned, there are these infrastructure problems that are a direct result of groundwater loss, and they're also creating long-term problems for surface water delivery. And one of the reasons for this heavy groundwater loss is a massive shift in agriculture, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley. There's been a huge shift from annual crops like tomatoes, alfalfa, corn, cotton, that kind of thing, to permanent crops like pistachios and mandarin oranges, almonds, These are permanent crops that require water every year, all year long, unlike the annual crops that can be fallowed in a drought. Many of these crops are, a vast majority of the production is exported to places like China and Europe, particularly the nut crops. So in essence, it's a way of that we're exporting California water all over the world. And this water is it's either free or it's really cheap. So it's a huge, essentially a huge agricultural subsidy. And with that, I think I'll pause and we'll move along.
Thank you, Matt. You made so many great points that I know I already see people in the audience jumping to follow up on. Last but not least is Christiana Peppard, professor of theology, science, and ethics at Fordham University in New York. And she is the author of a book that I have highlighted, underlined, dog-eared. It's one of those on my bookshelf. So you might be wondering why we've asked a religion scholar to join us in a talk about water scarcity. Her book is Just Water, Theology, Ethics, and the Global Water Crisis, and this is her expertise. As we learned on the Religion Beat dinner last night, faith communities are beginning to have a real impact on water and climate stories, on water and climate issues around the country and around the world. I think they're an important new voice in our stories, and they're also key to how our culture will come to live differently with water. So, Christiana, thank you so much for being with us from New York.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and I'm having a bit of a hero worship moment being on the panel with these three folks, because the work of Cynthia, Jay, and Matt in different ways charts a really nice three-dimensional sense of what water is looking like and will continue to look like in dry and water-scarce areas in the 21st century. So thanks for having me. All right, first disclaimer, yes, I'm a professor of religion. My PhD is in religious studies. I'm also an interdisciplinary mutt. And why religion, why theology in particular? Well, it's about questions of value and how different communities, whether religious or political, economic, or scientific, value different kinds of data, different kinds of environmental and ecological contexts. Water is the unifying thread throughout a lot of my work. And I actually am not going to talk much about religious communities and activism, but rather I'm going to talk about some big picture water questions from a humanities angle informed by environmental and hydrological science. Because I'm a teacher, I'll tell you in advance that there are four areas, and there's an elaboration of each, and then an example. All right, so the first situation with regard to fresh water is that there's this invisibility paradox. That's what I call it, at least. Fresh water is a problem, a reality that in much of the developed world has been invisible for so long. Why? Well, it's a mark of privilege. The water comes immediately to our taps 24/7, almost. So it's only when, say, California gets into a massive drought, or there's some kind of conflict in the Middle East in which water is a factor, or construction of a dam on the Blue Nile gets some sort of political tensions heightened, that we hear about water. So water is invisible until there's a flare-up, and then it subsides into the realm of unasked questions again. Now, as journalists, you are in an amazing opportunity, given the increased attention to water since, I don't know, about 2008 or so. And I think that Jay's work in particular, and a lot of what Matt was saying about groundwater, is really the next horizon in environmental reporting, as well as in just basic civic education. I like to say that aquifers are the most important things you'll never see. And that's a really interesting thing, because it's only recently that the satellite technology, various other forms of groundwater mapping have become feasible, so that we can begin to understand that which is underneath our feet, which is both literally and metaphorically holding up civilizations. And it's when we begin to realize that societies, we'll just talk about the U.S. West for now, but it's true for Mexico, it's true for China, it's true around the world. Societies have been extracting groundwater at an unsustainable rate that does not equal the rate of aquifer renewal. That's the crux, as I understand it, of the global freshwater crisis. But it's a crux that is, again, subterranean. So it's invisible. How do we make the invisible visible? The second aspect about freshwater that I think is really important in terms of reporting and also a big challenge has to do with the complexity. So Matt and Jay have differently pointed out that there's a lot of scientific data, a lot of unknowns in the realm of, still, even though Jay's working to fix this problem, in the realm of groundwater mapping, say with the Ogallala Group in the High Plains Aquifer. But there's also a ton of complexity and unknowns in the realm of water rights, which in California differ a little bit from the Southeast. And so there's just a ton to unpack regionally, and then to look at on national and international scales. And Elizabeth Royt, in her, I think it's a 2008 book, Bottle Mania, commented on what kinds of water issues get press time. And she said that usually, you know, it's the water war flare-ups, or it's Nestle doing something with bottled water, or it's the Cochabamba Bolivia riots. And partly that's understandable. You know, it's the big, ooh, exciting, you know, shiny object stories that get press time. But these topics of who owns the right to water, how is it adjudicated, how is it monitored, those are really important questions that often get overlooked. And Royt, in the quote from her is that a lot of those issues are too outré or not popular enough for mainstream. Oh, it's Elizabeth Royt here. Hi, good to see you. Yay, okay.
I was wondering if you knew she was in the audience.
Oh my gosh, that's
Elizabeth,
so great.
Raise your hand.
Yeah.
There she is.
So I quote you in chapter 3 of my book. You know, most of these questions are too outré for mainstream audiences, right? Property rights, allocations, long-term planning. So again, how do you adjudicate as journalists the scientific complexities and unknowns as well as the political, economic, legal, and value frameworks as uncertainties and unknowns? Also, that notion of beneficial use. Can someone please take down the notion of beneficial use? As, I mean, it's important, but it needs to be expanded to include ecological ecosystem services as well as, you know, groundwater recharge and that sort of thing. Okay, this brings us to the third point, which is about objectivity. And I encounter anxiety around water talk a lot. Like, as a professor, I have a somewhat easier task than you guys do because I can write an opinion piece and have a strong opinion and say, hey, water is essential. It's the most valuable thing we've got. It undergirds absolutely everything, food products, energy production, and so forth. And so here's what I think we should do. Jay wrote a really great LA Times op-ed last week, 2 weeks ago, that, again, says, here's what I think. Here's the data. Here's the problem. Here's what we should do. As journalists, I know that you have a different kind of relationship to opinion pieces, and there's a premium placed on objectivity. And I don't have any big solutions here except to say that consistent awareness to the frames of value in which the reporting is done do make a difference. And I think that this is a case where sometimes the facts do have values packed in with them, you know? Water is essential. It's non-substitutable. So implicitly, I think, there is a value on conservation, on thinking wisely and well about water use. And I know that some journalism sectors would say, well, let's present two sides of the story. I don't think that's true, really, when it comes to water and when it comes to environmental goods. Because what we're talking about is survival of people, ecosystems, and societies on all levels of scale. Fact value issues, freshwater problematizes them. Fourth part, hot leads looking ahead. Jay and Matt both brought up the agriculture, energy, water nexus issues. Those are big ones. I find that when I'm talking and teaching about water, people get a little turned off by those terms because it sounds like something that you need to have a PhD in international political economy to understand. So one way into these topics is through the idea of virtual water, a notion that was developed by a sociologist in the UK named Tony Allen, A-L-L-A-N, now emeritus. And then a similar idea, water footprint, by Arjen Hoekstra, H-O-E-K-S-T-R-A, that basically tries to chart, say, how much water goes into the perennial production of almonds in the Central Valley, how much water is in your tomato. Some of those pieces or infographics you may have seen in terms of, say, the meat, the water content of a hamburger. That's all virtual water, and I think that's a really important educational tool that people can visualize in concrete ways. I think there's a lot of opportunity in environmental journalism on water for multi-platform communications, and some of the, again, infographics, animations, videos, there's a ton out there at the intersection of the emerging technologies and science, as well as bringing to consciousness some of these issues of invisibility. Some other possible pitch topics or things that I think will be really big in coming years: population. How do we think about population and fresh water? Population can be a really thorny issue, and it gets a lot of people righteously pissed off in one direction or another. So it's going to be really important that we learn to unpack demographic data, rates of use of fresh water, both consumptive and non-consumptive, by different kinds of populations, and really think carefully about how population and freshwater use intersect. Dams, of course. Everybody loves a good dam demolition story. So those are going to continue to be important. But in historical perspective, as well as future perspective, looking at how things like World Bank and IMF loans intersect with the water infrastructure development trajectory on which many nations in the global south and other parts of the not yet industrialized world are dealing with their water. A lot of rules have been set by global organizations on paradigms that might not be the best socially or ecologically. Similarly, infrastructure. David Sedlak's, he's at UC Berkeley, his new book, Water 4.0, Yale Press 2014, is a great history of water infrastructure and a pretty solid prospective analysis of what we're going to need to think about as a U.S. society in terms of making enough water accessible and sustainable for everyone. Well, let's see. And then, of course, there's conflicts, the wars, the flare-ups, all of that. One that I haven't seen very many stories on, and I'd love to see a story on this, is on the role of water vapor as a greenhouse gas and how that relates to climate change. I think I'll close with a quote from one of my other heroes, besides the three folks to my right. That's Joan Didion, who in her essay Holy Water, which is indeed a holy text to me, she begins it by saying, some of us who live in arid parts of the world think about water with a reverence that others might find excessive. And later on in the essay, she says, very few people are able to carry their side of the conversation when I start talking about water delivery systems. One of my hopes as an educator, as a citizen of the U.S. and globally, is that collectively we can begin to help people think in more nuanced, constructive ways about this vital, essential, non-substitutable baseline for existence that is fresh water, in such a way that we collectively are able to manage it for the good of ourselves now, ecosystems, and future generations. Thanks.
Wow, that was wonderful. Thank you so much, Christiana. I want to tell you two things. On Wednesday, the Wilson Center devoted an entire day for us, devoted to population dynamics, so that to help environmental journalists understand how population weaves into all of our stories. And so anyone who wasn't at that day, it was a great day, and the Wilson Center has some really great statistics that we can use for our stories on how population influences water supply, climate change, disaster, all sorts of topics. And then on the multi-platform issue, I was in a panel yesterday at which someone talked about KQED just had a story on wildfire told entirely through comics. So you might take a look at that. That was really interesting. So I'm gonna ask Jay a dumb question. Jay, I don't know if Jay probably knows this. Journalists are taught to ask the dumb question, but we're often embarrassed to, but we do it anyway. So I'm gonna ask the dumb question to take it off my colleagues, who are surely thinking, wait a minute, in elementary school we learn about this hydrological cycle. Water never vanishes. It can't disappear, right? So where is it going when you look in the satellites and it's leaving the aquifers? Where's it going?
So excellent question, not dumb at all. Thank you for asking it. If you think back to that map that I showed, so no, we're not losing water at all, but we are moving it around from place to place, and that's the issue. And so, like I said, when we talked about the land, so first of all, there's exchange, right? Water's moving from the land to the ocean, from the ice sheets to the ocean, so it's moving around in a macro sense, but also it's moving around on the land. And so I talked about the places that were getting dry in the mid-latitudes and that were getting wetter in the high latitudes in the Arctic and in the tropics. And when we take our data and average it up, it averages to zero. But, you know, it's unfortunate if you live in California, if you live in one of these, you know, red spots, because, like we were saying, we don't really have the legal, and the legal stuff is a total mess. We don't have the legal infrastructure, the policy infrastructure to really move it around. Everyone always says, well, just, you know, build a pipeline from whatever, Oregon or something. Why, you know, why not? So it's moving around. That's the answer.
Okay, thank you. Matt, my follow-up question for you is, here you told us in your story that California has allocated 5 times more water, more surface water than exists in its rivers. So how can a new groundwater law solve these problems, or how do you think that's going to work when our pattern is to over-allocate? And I live in Florida, where groundwater has been regulated and permitted since 1972, and it's often a disaster, and it's often over-permitted. So if you could speak sort of to the politics of what that will be like to regulate groundwater.
Well, I think that's sort of the million-dollar question about the groundwater law. As we're seeing, the surface water laws don't really work that well, so why should we expect more from the groundwater law? I guess the main advancement of the groundwater law is that it's going to begin to gather data about how much groundwater we're extracting. That's going to take some time. You know, it's not something that's going to help us in this drought. What we do with that information is really the political question, as it is with the surface water. There are political solutions to the surface water legislation or enforcement flaws that I talked about earlier, but there isn't the political will to do it because so much of the surface water is held by influential people and corporations. You know, one of the reasons there aren't more state employees to enforce surface water withdrawals is that the senior water rights holders pay no fees to the state for their water rights. It's a grandfathered system in which, you know, arbitrarily in 1914, the state said, after this date, you must get a permit and pay an annual fee. And it's a nominal fee. It's not exorbitant at all. But prior to 1914, the state just said, we're just going to leave this alone, keep taking the water. We're not going to charge you a fee. So the state just doesn't have the financial resources to put more people out in the field. Mm-hmm. It could change that law, but it hasn't been willing to. And if you look at how long it took to get a groundwater law in place, it's not very encouraging that there will be more done for surface water. I've been at the Bee for 10 years, and I started writing about the problems with groundwater extraction back then and the lack of regulation, and many people were writing about it long before me, and it's only last week that we got a law passed, and it's a law that doesn't do everything that a lot of people think we need to do, but it's a start. Mm-hmm. So politics play a big role for sure.
Yeah, thank you. And Christiana, something we struggle with when we try to write about water, you make such eloquent points about, you know, the private and the worries over commodification of water, and yet when we interview our utility directors or water economists, they make this excellent point that we do need to pay more for water, and there's this real conflict, it seems to me, between those two very important ideas. So do you have a way to help us explain that in our stories or to rectify that difference?
Well, that's a tough one and a great one. One of the things that I think is important in a panel on Beyond the Water Wars, excuse me, is to recognize that not all conflicts involve weapons, but are conflicts of conceptual paradigms. With regard to the commodification of water, a lot of global water justice advocates have very rightly objected to the idea that private multinational corporations could be the sole purveyors of water supply for a population, because there is a justice issue that those who are least able to pay can be cut out of the service circuit. That's a really important justice point. At the same time, people also point out that water is treated, even as a default entity, in an economic way. That the default concept of value in an era of economic globalization falls to the market or to notions of price. That's an important concept too, and what water justice advocates try to add to that is that, well, hey, that's possibly okay, but the value of water is something fuller. I think that's where the humanities can come in, mm-hmm. just as an aside. So there's that sort of reality about the debate between water rights and water pricing folks. But then there's also this reality that, you know, Matt and Jay can speak adroitly to, which is that water is profoundly subsidized mm-hmm. in a range of forms, through agricultural subsidies, through a very, very low pricing, you know, pennies per gallon, if that, in a lot of places in the U.S., at least. And so what we pay for water doesn't necessarily reflect the actual, even just economic costs, bracketing ecological, et cetera, costs for now. It doesn't really reflect actual economic costs of things like water infrastructure, not only for freshwater provision, but also for sewage, for stormwater, all those sorts of categories. So water pricing and what the necessities are, how we need to recoup certain kinds of costs in order to keep systems running now and in the future, is one really important angle. Also, what are the limits to water pricing? What are the ethical limits to water pricing, and how do we think about that? And that's, you know, that's a challenge as journalists, because, you know, you're sort of supposed to come up with these really short, pithy leads for a 900-word article, and it's supposed to be accurate universally. But water, while universal, is also very, very particular to place and to the conceptual paradigm in which it operates.
That's good. That's a really difficult issue. So we're going to open it up to audience questions. And let me just go over the rules of audience questions quickly. We will call on SEJ members first. And the other rule is no speeches. So are you going to pass around the microphone? Thank you.
Sure. Let's start here.
Hi, Amy Quinton, Capital Public Radio. I know you guys. And I actually have questions for...
In Sacramento,
yes. For Jay and Matt. Jay, first of all, I just would like to get sort of your opinion on the groundwater legislation that passed and if you think it's going to make a difference, given how good we are at policing ourselves. And then, Matt, I'd also like to hear from you about water rights and how you think that journalists can cover that story, given that when I mention it to my editor, he yawns. So...
So first, thanks for your coverage in the past. We really, really appreciate it. So of course, the legislation is really a step in the right direction, and it's because of the help of the press and the focus over the in particular over this year that I think really helped make it happen. So it's a step in the right direction. I think some of the challenges are going to be in the implementation. And the enforcement. One of the biggest things we need to do is measure the withdrawals. That's going to be really, really hard to do. And when you think about what's happening in California, we have an existing infrastructure for management through the State Water Resources Control Board and the regional boards, which I actually sit on one of the regional boards. But those are really based, built upon surface water. And, aquifers have different shapes, right, than river basins. So these water quality control boards are based on the 9 or so big river basins in California. And so will we give the job of enforcement to the water quality control boards, or will we have to, build up some new infrastructure? So to me, sort of the details of the implementation will dictate what happens in the next few years.
So, covering water rights. In California, it's difficult because even these paper statements that the water rights holders file, they're not digitized in any way on the State Water Resources Control Board website. They are available on the website, but only as PDFs. So you can pull up a PDF of their annual statement. You can pull up a PDF of their actual water right, and if you have someone who can work with those in your newsroom to strip out the data into a database, that would be useful. But and we do have somebody like that in my newsroom, but there's just such an enormous number of documents. As we mentioned at the start, the state has curtailed about 10,000 junior water rights, meaning that they had to stop diverting this year. And that's just a subset of the water rights in California, 10,000. So nevertheless, one way to approach it is to pick a place in the state and go into the state's website and look at water rights in that particular region. And you can do keyword searches. And one way that I used these this year was when the state announced those curtailments. I started thinking about, who's going to be affected, and because serious fires often come with drought years in California, I started to look at whether any fire departments had water rights curtailed, so I could search the forms that way. And lo and behold, it turned out that the State Department of Fire and Forestry had a number of water rights that were curtailed. And some of those water rights they use for firefighting to actually fill tanker trucks that they take out in the woods to fight fires. The state created a way to make exceptions for critical water needs, so that those rights were not curtailed. But nevertheless, that was made for a good story. And so I would hone in on a particular region and use keywords for critical agencies that rely on water. Another thing I found just through kind of random searching that way, there's contact information for all these water rights holders, and I started calling a few of them randomly, and I found that in several cases, the water rights that were curtailed were very old and had not been used recently. In some cases, they were small communities that used the water right to fill a tank to pressurize a small hydrant system in a rural area of cabins. And in some cases, the actual entity that held the water right had sort of been dissolved because people had moved away and they weren't really using the water right anymore. They'd since been hooked up to a different water source for firefighting, so they weren't even using this water right anymore. So that highlights kind of how flawed this whole water rights system is, because, you know, someone may not even be using a water right anymore. So the shorter answer is it's kind of like a needle in a haystack thing at this point. You got to hunt around, but there are a lot of gems in there.
I'm Tony Davis from the Arizona Daily Star. I'm curious about the whole paradox of, you know, the major amount of conservation of water now going on in the West, and the fact that in many cases it's the water utilities depend on revenue to keep themselves going, so they have to raise the rates, and so the more you conserve, the more the rates go up. I'd be curious to get are there any ways out of this? You know, is there any solutions to this to decouple? That's what I've heard one person talk about. And a second question is much... Oh, I'm sorry, then go ahead. That's it.
Tell everyone
about that. Yeah.
Does anyone want to tackle the water rate story where the utilities... So the issue is that utilities say... And Los Angeles is a good example. There's this big pipe burst, you know, water floods UCLA, and LA is saying they have to raise water rates for two reasons: the aging infrastructure and the fact that people are using less and less and less, and they're receiving less revenue.
Yeah, so I think this gets really nicely to the question of governance and the where on the spectrum water management entities fall with regard to responsibility to generate profit, if so, for what purposes, to shareholders or to reinvestment in technology, versus public good. And I don't think there are one-size-fits-all answers to this problem, but it is thorny. And I'm really glad you raised this, because this issue of how utilities are currently structured, if people conserve, the utilities have to raise the rates in order to make money. That's an issue for water. It's also an issue for electricity and energy on decentralized sort of grid systems, as we're seeing popping up with solar and so forth. And there's a real, real brewing conflict here that transcends water that also applies to energy.
So just a real quick follow-up. So a little anecdote. So I work at UC Irvine. I was professor there for 13 years. And if you've been to the Irvine campus, it's super lush, right? And so I've talked during the drought to our facilities guru, who's really into sustainability, and just talked about cutting back on water use. And he said, well, we can't cut back because we are the biggest cut. So it's all reclaimed water, which means it's partially treated. Well, we're the biggest customer of Irvine Ranch Water District for reclaimed water. And so if we don't buy it, then, like, that's going to throw, you know, the water prices will get jacked up for everyone else. So it's kind of crazy.
That's great. Tony, I have a quick follow-up. An excellent source on this issue is Marianne Dickinson at the Alliance for Water Efficiency in Chicago. I know many of us have interviewed her, and sometimes it's simply not really the story that utilities have to raise their rates because people are conserving. That is that is the story they're telling us. But if you dig a little deeper, you might see some lack of planning, to put it nicely. So she's a wonderful source of information.
Okay.
Mary Ann Dickinson with the Chicago-based Alliance for Water Efficiency. And a friend of SEJ, she's spoken here in recent years. She's very good. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Nina Satija from the Texas Tribune. There's been some groundwater regulation in Texas for a long time, but one of the things we're starting to realize is that groundwater and surface water are, in fact, connected.
Congratulations.
But right now, shockingly, the only way to really deal with that is if you file an endangered species lawsuit like they did in San Antonio. So, you know, you were showing us these maps of groundwater depletion across the globe. Do we know much about the connection? I mean, you know, just from a global sort of data standpoint, that's got to be affecting surface water supplies.
Oh,
how
yeah.
much do we
oh, yeah,
how course. Much do we know about that?
Right. Well, so we actually know quite a bit. So it's embarrassing. My kids were born in Texas. I was on the faculty at UT Austin for a long time, and some of what happens there is a little bit embarrassing as a hydrologist. So it's extremely well. It's one water. You know, you hear the term sometimes, especially in NGOs. Oh, it's one water. It is one water. I mean, it's moving around from the surface into the soils, into the aquifer, out into the streams, intimately well connected.
I'm a Doug Struck, a freelance out of Boston. Boston's that nice blue area up there, and it's kind of tough for most of folks in that area to look at the water situation, the drought situation that you're talking about. Is
right.
So the question is.
For a larger audience.
All right. The question is for Jay. Are there larger issues for the Northeast, for example, you know, other than obviously the increased severity of downpours
right.
and perhaps the increased cost of food?
Right.
Aside from that, what issues do you see for people who live in the Northeast?
Okay.
That they
so now we're going to get into my geographic demographic history. So I'm actually a native Rhode Islander. And so when I was, which happens to be red on that, check that out. So when I was growing up, so I was born in 1960, and you would never, ever, ever consider playing in those streams, ever. Why? Because they were just as filthy, they were just considered to be, you know, waste dumps, toxic waste dumps. So the issues there remain to be mainly issues of water quality rather than water quantity. And, of course, with you know the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, there's been centuries of dumping and environmental neglect. And so those are the bigger issues. And you're right about the flooding stuff.
I second everything he said. In addition, the way I think about scarcity as a general term that can apply to everyone is that there are two kinds of scarcity. One is, and this is consonant with Jay's work as well, one is in terms of quantity, so that's the issue that applies to arid places, the U.S. West and so forth. The other is quality, polluted places, places where the water is not potable. That applies to some parts of Rhode Island, Massachusetts, but also to a number of places in the developing world. Major pitch and story opportunities in the future in terms of the reclamation, reuse, or recycling of polluted water here at the intersection of emerging technologies, including biotechnologies, the use of synthetic biology, and in terms of the energy industry, can wastewater from very thirsty energy projects like hydraulic fracturing, I write about that in my book, can that water be reclaimed or reused in a meaningful way? Probably can't be recycled. Recycled means made potable again. But how technologies are changing the shape of water supply is going to be a major, major set of stories for the future.
Hi, Susan Moran, freelance journalist in Colorado. It's just to ask a little bit more from Tony's question. I still don't get why there is not or isn't a bigger debate around the decoupling issue. Because wasn't it years ago when the California PG&E and the utilities industry decoupled profits from use? And can that not be a model, or is that just such a naive question to begin with?
So, not my total area of expertise, but I think, yes, it could be a model. And I've seen a couple pieces on Circle of Blue. Wanted to give a shout out to them, as well as Great Water Reporting Consortium, that deal with this kind of question. But it really, both I think in the academic literature as well as in practical literature, it really is a question in its infancy. And partly because it's been an invisible problem. It hasn't applied to most municipalities until recently. And it's also a long-term problem. And for people who are working in their jobs in various utility commissions, you may or may not be able to devote a ton of resources towards long-term public good planning. Susan, do you live in Boulder? And you do the, this is an aside, everyone, sorry, but you do the occasional radio show.
Yeah,
yeah. All right. So anyway, hi. We'll talk later. Yeah, nice to meet you.
Follow-up. Susan, I'm working on a story about this topic right now for Enzia, and it's a really difficult topic to understand. And one thing I think is not explained well enough is how much of the business world gets its water for free and how much utility ratepayers are picking up the tab. I don't know if you were in the pollution, the water pollution seminar yesterday. You know, we were talking about the cause of the algae in Lake Erie that led to Toledo's drinking water crisis was caused for the most part by agriculture, but the people who will have to pay for the $1 billion new plant to deal with the algae are ratepayers. And so this is something that, you know, we can hopefully clarify the more we come to write about price. We need to be able to explain this in the larger context of how much the largest water users pay, including ag and energy, which is often zero. They make the case that they pay for the infrastructure to draw the water. But I think that's an important point, and I just wanted to make sure it didn't get lost.
All right, great. Hi.
Just something real quick to add to that. An example from Sacramento. We have a Nestle water bottling plant in Sacramento that came in a few years ago. It was approved by the city. They bottle tap water, but they don't pay any more for that tap water than I do. And you know, the justification was, well, they're bringing jobs, so there's an economic benefit to the city. That's a, you know, obviously a rich thing to explore as a reporter. Should a business like that pay more for water than residents if they're turning around and making a profit off of that water that essentially taxpayers have paid to take out of the river and purify? Another example is that industry generally, I've been told, is a relatively untapped well of conservation potential. And the example I recently reported on is in Santa Rosa. It happens to be where Amy's Kitchen makes these organic microwavable meals, you know. They package them there, and the city of Santa Rosa has a rather aggressive water conservation program where they hire, the city paid a consultant to help their people understand how industrial food systems work in order to better communicate with Amy's Kitchen about how to save water. And it saved Amy's Kitchen money, and it saved the city water and therefore money to process that water.
Hi, Meg Turville Heights from University of Wisconsin. One of the things that we have in our really water-rich area is we hear about a lot of the solutions. We'll at some point talk about putting a big straw in the Great Lakes and taking it to other areas. So I'm kind of curious. The only solutions that we've kind of heard about are a little bit of a groundwater and a little bit of the conservation. Are there other things that people are looking at for trying to address some of these issues in a very populous region?
All right. One of my hobby horses is the hydraulic ideologies and optimism that took root in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the U.S. and which we are still suffering the hangovers from in many ways. There have been, since that time, an ongoing proposals to divert the Mississippi or Missouri rivers to bring that water to Vegas, an economically productive area. So Pat Mulroy, you know, and someone should write a biography of her. She's so interesting and powerful, even in her retirement. And then similar proposals about the Great Lakes, Canadian water. These are, you know, they're compelling because they use our engineering savvy to redirect nature and to exert control over water. And I personally think that those are not the way to go, but they are attractive to people, partly because we can do it, so why not? And partly because the technological fix is really enticing. If we can just build something and move the water around, and that fixes the problem, then great. But I don't think it's that simple. And I think that people who endorse those solutions often have a limited perspective on what constitutes good water management and long-term viability.
And I might point out that in the Great Lakes, we have the Great Lakes Water Compact, which requires keeping water in the basin and conserving water in the basin. We know about the straw, and we don't want it to come.
Hi. Introduce yourself. Yes, I know. I'm David Helvarg. I am an author, and I write a lot about salt water, you know, that other 97% of the hydraulic cycle. And in California, I mean, it's this contradiction that we're really good stewards of our ocean and really bad stewards of our fresh water. As soon as I get home, I'm going to try and read your series, Matt. We know that, you know, in the midterm, really, not even the long term, we're going to lose the Sierra snowpack, which is a third of our water. And so maybe you could talk about the suite of alternatives to adapt and keep, you know, bringing water to 38 million and more people with the loss of the snowpack.
And I might point out we've got 5 minutes left, so let's keep these answers questions short.
That's certainly a biggie. Not only is the snowpack shrinking, but the timing by which it melts is changing too, which has implications for flood control as well as water supply. How do we adapt to that? Well, one way is to change how we operate dams. Right now, most of the dams in California are operated according to 50-year-old rule books that were developed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers around the idea that snowmelt usually occurs at the same time every year, and reservoirs have to be operated during the winter time to avoid floods. And this is a particular concern in Sacramento, where we also have big flooding concerns. Well, Folsom Dam in my area is one of the first in California that's slowly switching to something called forecast-based operations, which means that you control the water releases from the dam based on the actual weather around you, as opposed to waiting until April or May to change how much water you let out of the dam, which is kind of the way it works now. During winter, you're required to leave a certain amount of room in the reservoir to capture flood runoff. But if you're in a drought year, that's a problem because you can't capture the maximum amount of rainfall that might occur from the one storm, the one big storm that you get all winter long. So they're changing the rule curves, they're called, on how you operate dams in order to capture those one-time big runoff events in the wintertime and not have to let it out of the dam to maintain that arbitrary fixed amount of storage. The other big answer, of course, is to get way more aggressive on conservation. If I remember right, in Australia, after their big drought, which recently ended, they brought their consumption down to something like 30 gallons of water per person per day. And in California, the average is still, I think, 200 gallons per person per day. So there's still a lot we can do with conservation.
Hi, my name is Zoe Schlanger. I write for Newsweek. Christiana, you mentioned before about reclaiming water and the potential to reclaim water from major projects like fracking. I have a question about that. We know that injection wells from fracking fluid is maybe causing earthquakes. Evaporation ponds from fracking fluids are causing really toxic air pollution. Reclaiming it might not work. Is there any good way to get rid of water from these things?
Is there any good way to get rid of the produced water and flow back from fracking wells? The short answer is not really. My challenge to scientists, policymakers, and corporations would be, let's figure out how to get the kinds of energy we need in ways that don't use, in the sense of consumptive use, that don't use fresh water. To that end, I think the move to reuse produced and flowback water in the next series of fracking operations is promising. A lot of industry advocates are like, wow, this is amazing. Yeah, it's fine. It's good. It's a step in the right direction. But part of the problem and what we're seeing at the Energy Water Nexus is that a great many fossil fuel extraction technologies for non-conventional petroleum products use copious quantities of fresh water, 3 to 5 million gallons, for example, in your standard fracking well in the Marcellus Shale and parts of Pennsylvania. So it just seems to me that there are more innovative ways to generate energy than the norm. And I think that a major consideration in the future is how can we generate energy without depleting fresh water supplies and consuming that water such that it really can't be used again for anything and has negative downstream effects on air or earthquakes or human health.
That's an excellent question. Jay has a quick response, and then I think we have time for one more question. After Jay, and then one more question, and then I encourage everyone to keep talking. We'll move for coffee, but we can keep the conversation going. Go ahead, Jay.
So I've attended a number of meetings with the shale oil and gas industry, and so it turns out that there is a deep interest in the industry in doing a better job, believe it or not. And of course, they have the resources, financial and technological. So the resources are in place for that industry to do a much better job on all aspects of water water servicing, from the amount of water used to dealing with its containment and monitoring its flow in the environment to extracting it. It can do a much better job, and so the challenge, you know, we have to pressure them to step up and embrace that challenge, because we can challenge governments around the world, and they are responding to look for more environmentally safe energy alternatives. But you know, there's a whole community out there that believes that the shales are a blessing, and it is we will probably exploit them until we come up with something better.
Can I just add two people to follow on Twitter about this? One is a guy, his Twitter handle is Shale Gas Expert, and another is Brian Jordan, both on Twitter, both deal with energy and fracking in particular.
Hi, I'm Erica Guise. I'm an independent reporter, and my question sort of ties together some of the things that we've been talking about. You know, there's been a big demographic shift in the last 50 years or so where people have been moving to the Sun Belt, you know, with these big water projects and with air conditioning. And, you know, we talked about a future with water haves and have-nots and these sort of idealized massive infrastructure projects where we might actually move water across the country. But then, of course, there's things like the Great Lakes Compact where people with water have the foresight to hold on to it. And I'm wondering, probably mostly Jay and Christiana, whether you think that there might, in the future, the demographics might be to have people moving toward the Midwest, toward the Northeast, where there is actually water.
I don't think that we'll do that. And the reason that I don't, of course we should, right? But I don't think that we will because we are spoiled.
Well, that was succinct. Some cities in the U.S. West simply should not exist from a hydrological perspective. One is Phoenix. Sorry, Arizonans. Great book on this topic is called Bird on Fire. I think it will be an interesting longitudinal question as to how U.S. populations, with our privilege and our spoiled access to infrastructure, move in relation to climate change and related hydrological realities. Globally, we see this with environmental migrants and environmental refugees. Most Americans have not had to encounter this yet. Will we?
Excellent. Thank you so much. Erica, I'd like to just point you to quickly a couple of cattle operations in Texas have been shuttered, and we are seeing more grass-fed cattle operations moving into Florida. So I would look at the possibility of businesses and how they're moving around the country in response to drought and climate change. Thank you all for coming, and I really want to give our panelists a round of applause for coming so far.